This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the December 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. We'll be speaking with JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is an Associate Professor of Family Medicine and Director of the Residency Training Program. Dr. Sloan and Brown, welcome to JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you, Wayne. Glad to be here.
Thanks, Wayne.
So today we'll be discussing three main topics: the effects of exer gaming, and we'll find out what that is, on cognitive and social function in people with dementia, how post-acute and long-term care facilities should deal with COVID-19 if there are multiple other respiratory viruses around this winter, and the nursing home survey process after Kirkland, and whether or how it should be changed. Our first paper sounds very interesting, with a term that I am not familiar with until now. It reports the results of a randomized trial of exer gaming on persons with dementia. And Dr. Sloan, Dr. Brown, tell us a little bit more about this study.
Well, let's start by discussing what exer gaming is. I didn't know the word either, but most people in our audience will also know it once we explain it, because some exer games have become really popular. The first exer game I heard about was the Wii, which was introduced in 2006 by Nintendo, and it became quite a fad. I remember I was working at a PACE program at the time, and they got one, and next thing I know, we had these participants doing things like simulated bowling and stuff like that. But within a few years, at least in the general world of electronics, other gaming platforms, particularly PlayStation, took the lion's share of the gaming market. This piece is about a bicycle exer game that sounds a lot like the Peloton, which is popular now.
I have a Peloton, and so I was eager to read a little bit more about the relationship between what I do at 5 o'clock in the morning and what we're asking our patients to do, or our residents in our facilities to do. And this article was really interesting. Tell us more about this study, Phil.
Yeah, but before you do that, I just want to say, let us not count out the Wii. We have one, it still works, and my children, now in their 20s, are still using the Wii for simulated bowling. I just want to say.
This is so great. So when they're 85 or 90, they'll have that muscle memory.
That's right.
Well, this particular study took place in the Netherlands. The intervention was interactive cycling using a stationary bicycle connected to a screen. And while they were cycling, the person with dementia would see a route on the screen. They can pick a route with help from a caregiver or therapist, and the screen mimics the experience of cycling outside, thus offering simultaneous physical and cognitive stimulation.
That's really interesting. That's an option on my Peloton, but certainly not quite the same as Cody Rigsby telling me what I need to do and how fast I need to go. Tell me more, Phil.
Okay. Well, the study involved having to buy or lease one of several systems at a discount. I checked out the one that was described in English, and it's called the SilverFit Mile. It has over 100 routes all over the world. Also, it allows a caregiver to take and upload videos on their own, thereby creating familiar routes.
That's really cool. It sounds like a lot of fun, particularly if you like to bicycle. Tell us how that study was designed and what did they find, Phil?
Well, it was conducted in 23 adult day centers. Participants were persons with dementia and their family caregivers. The outcomes of interest were changes in physical function, changes in cognitive function, and health outcomes such as falls. The subjects were randomized to by the adult day center. And altogether, the study ended up with 73 people with dementia in the experimental group and 39 in the control group. So coming from 23 day centers, you can see that this was a select group.
Does that have anything to do with why the groups were unbalanced in size?
That is a bit suspicious. You know, the authors don't really talk about it, but the control group participated in the usual day center activities. So there wasn't much of an incentive to enroll or at least stay in the control group. On the other hand, the experimental group got to use this newfangled bike. And I'll bet that hooked the caregivers to sign up for the study in a way signing up for the control group didn't. We didn't find out if it was blinded, and I suspect it wasn't. So anyway, it's suspicious that the assignment was not random.
So we're a bit skeptical about the comparability of the groups. Did the authors compare those two groups then?
Well, it turns out they did, and there were no differences in gender, cognitive status, living situation, educational level, marital status, caregiver characteristic. In fact, pretty much everything they measured. The only difference, and this is not surprising at all, was that people in the extra game group had more experience in cycling.
That's good. I suppose that would make people a little more interested in participating. But the groups seem similar. Drumroll, please. Phil, what did they find out?
Well, they found, and not surprisingly, the results were mixed. No significant effect on physical function, measured using a short performance battery, but some small to moderately positive effects on cognitive and social function, small reductions in distress, subjective burden, and sense of competence of the informal caregivers. And additionally, although not statistically significant, they did observe clinically relevant effect sizes on physical activity, interest, or enjoyment.
Unfortunately, it sort of sounds like a definite maybe. What's your bottom line, Phil?
Well, I think the biggest lesson is that this, like so many interventions in persons with dementia, can't be expected to work miracles. It's the same with pretty much anything that requires one-on-one caregiving and therefore is only done a few hours a week. Music therapy is the same thing. The best you can expect from an intervention like these is to give the person a good time and for that glow of happiness for having taken part in something interesting to hang on for a while. Often many hours, and that's what we found it does.
That's really refreshing and sounds like a real positive. Would you say that physical or cognitive change is more difficult than a positive emotional effect?
Yes, and to be honest, isn't providing positive experiences the most important thing in dementia care? I think so. Doing things that are fun, doing things that have meaning, doing things that give a sense of accomplishment, doing things that bring joy.
I will say my Peloton brings me joy, so I think this is a great idea.
You know, I can't help but think, you know, you take anybody and you put them in a situation like that reminds them of a bicycle, they can't help but start pedaling. And I would think that no matter what you flashed before them, whether it was pictures of their family or something from their past, I think it would make things enjoyable, and really that's what we're after in the long-term care setting. So let's change gears, pardon the pun, and turn to that issue that continues to be on everyone's mind. I don't know if you've heard of it, COVID-19. So the 2020 December issue of JAMDA has two papers that are of particular interest as we are now in the midst of the beginning of winter. So Mallory, tell us a little bit about these papers.
Sure. As we all know, the winter respiratory virus season is always a tough time for our long-term care settings. This year, of course, COVID-19 will certainly add to the challenge of keeping our residents both safe and healthy. Our first article, The Winter Respiratory Viral Season During the COVID-19 Pandemic, focuses on some unique considerations for the health and well-being of residents and staff in long-term care settings. As we all know, and we've all faced before, there are lots of respiratory viruses. Many, particularly rhinoviruses, are around all year. But starting in December, we typically see a tripling or quadrupling of viruses in the community, including a variety of cold viruses, RSV and influenza, and parainfluenza. We call this the winter respiratory virus season or the flu season. This year, we can then expect all of this, and on top of it, COVID-19. Phil, you were one of the co-authors of this special article. Tell me, what were you thinking about as you wrote this?
Well, first of all, I'd like to give a shout out to Chrissy Kistler and Robin Jump, who did some of the main work on the paper. We were concerned that if we have a heavy virus season, like last year, plus COVID-19, the situation in long-term care is going to be even worse than it's been. I mean, imagine having a quarter of your staff with kids who have runny noses and coughs. Does everyone get tested? Do the staff quarantine themselves until all tests come back? You know, what if the staff member calls in and says their kid was playing with another child that had a runny nose, so they can't come in? You know, it goes on and on.
It sure does. At my home and amongst many of my colleagues, as well as my resident physicians, we've all dealt with exactly that issue. Small humans tend to have runny noses. So where do we draw the line? Anyway, getting back to the article, this paper identifies some key issues and priorities around infection prevention in our nursing home communities. First, it addresses preventing the spread. Facilities must redouble their efforts to counter the two ways that infections spread. Both influenza and COVID-19 mostly spread by droplets in the air. So it will be important to ensure that appropriate PPE is on hand to prevent the spread of COVID-19 this winter. Continued diligent universal screening is necessary, even if it has been 10 months that we've been doing that. Other viruses such as RSV, non-novel coronaviruses, adenovirus, and rhinovirus are mostly spread by people touching their nose or their face, and then touching surfaces such as door handles, handrails, elevator buttons, and so on. Therefore, in an effort to avoid all respiratory illness, the focus must not only be on airborne transmission and PPE, but also on hand washing and surface decontamination to prevent spread of all the winter viruses. Promoting immunizations is also key to promoting the well-being of our communities. Currently, the pneumonia vaccine and influenza vaccines are readily available, and while mandated to be an option for residents, research still shows that there is room for improvement in vaccinating our long-term care residents. Even when the seasonal influenza vaccine is not a particularly good match, these immunizations reduce both the incidence and the severity of the influenza, as well as help protect others through herd immunity. Authors suggest vaccinating annually with the flu and going ahead with vaccination if a resident is unaware of their status. This year, more than ever, it's important to ensure all staff also get vaccinated. AMDA does recommend mandating flu vaccines, but this certainly still remains up to the individual facilities at this time. And of course, I think this is true for all of us, the COVID vaccine is on all of our minds. The authors submitted this article for publication prior to recent updates and rollouts from both Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Now we know that the vaccines are available and may have already been available to the facilities that we work in if they're not coming soon. Current evidence suggests that mRNA vaccines appear safe and immunogenic in older populations, but whether such is the case for all patients and in all situations remains a significant concern. The question about cost was recently answered as the U.S. government announced plans to provide and administer COVID-19 vaccines to long-term care residents across the country with no out-of-pocket costs. Vaccinating staff will also be incredibly important to help to protect our vulnerable long-term care residents. We know there's a hesitancy that exists in receiving the vaccination, and so beginning to address those concerns now is both important and incredibly timely. Now that we have the COVID-19 vaccine, facilities must also work hard to get as many residents and staff immunized as possible. At least 70% is the minimum. Higher is certainly better. And as we're already finding out, we have to develop good ways of providing information and systems of administration and tracking that work well. Wayne and Phil, I know this paper was written before the vaccine was as imminent as it is now. Do you have any comments before I go on?
Yeah, Dr. Brown, I was thinking of two things as you were talking. The first one is there was a very interesting article that came out in USA Today on December 11th about getting both doses of either the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine. The Pfizer vaccine, there's a 28-day separation between two doses, and I think Moderna is 21. And the conclusion from a number of experts that were interviewed was that it's really important, regardless of the time span, to get that second dose. So many folks, and we know our patients often as well, don't want to get that second dose. And so we really have to make sure that they do. So making sure systems are set up for doing that, not just in the long-term care setting, but also in the short-term rehab setting, especially if folks have gotten one dose and then are going to be discharged. And the other thing I was thinking about with regard to the flu vaccine, as you were talking, was that the Gerontologic Society of America has hosts the National Adult Vaccination Program, which has a variety of wonderful resources promoting vaccination in general, and recently worked with AMDA on putting together some fact sheets on the enhanced vaccines. So definitely are some really great resources in making sure that folks get vaccinations like the flu vaccine, and that we're able to promote the need for those two vaccinations with regard to the mRNA vaccines that are now released.
I did receive my Moderna vaccine yesterday, and while my arm hurts, I'm here to talk about it, and I'm hopeful, certainly hopeful for, I keep saying hopeful for hugs in 2021, but we will see. So turning back away from the vaccine, there are several other points this paper made. One is that while we're frequently screened for symptoms daily and checked for flu in the past, this year we need to be especially vigilant. Clinicians should have a low threshold for COVID testing if respiratory symptoms develop. An important point to recognize is that a single case of COVID-19 infection among staff or residents at a nursing home is considered an outbreak. While that wasn't news to me, I needed to stop and rethink about it. During outbreaks, staff and residents should be tested for COVID-19 at least weekly until a two-week period transpires without identification of new cases. Another piece of important and interesting information is that for residents with symptoms of a respiratory infection and a negative COVID-19 test, influenza and RSV are the most likely causes of shortness of breath, fever, and pneumonia. And because only a small amount of viral media is needed for PCR testing for COVID-19, the nasal swab can be retained and retested for influenza and/or RSV, sparing the resident from that dreaded second nasopharyngeal swab, which can certainly be uncomfortable. One other point the article makes is to remember to be a good antibiotic steward when viruses are around. Many of us have likely erred on the side of caution and treated a potential pneumonia with antibiotics over the years, even though we thought it was viral bronchitis. In fact, statistics show that over 2/3 of viral lower respiratory infection are treated with antibiotics. Ugh. And this overuse of antibiotics contributes to our growing issue of antibiotic resistance. On the other side of the coin, delayed recognition of respiratory illness can lead to an outbreak amongst nursing home residents. How do you two approach that issue?
Well, Mallory, having worked in antibiotic stewardship quite a bit, I recognize that acute bronchitis, which is almost always viral, is one of the main reasons for antibiotic overuse. So I do my best to be a steward. But once again, if the resident is just super insistent or the family is, then I do my best to hold the line and say, we're going to monitor and see if it's really signs of pneumonia. Otherwise, we're better off saving the antibiotic for when they really need it.
Well, that's my approach as well. But to wrap this up, if there's a positive side to this year's winter respiratory virus season, it's that staff, residents, family members, and clinicians will be especially vigilant about potential infection.
And maybe, just maybe, this winter can be much better off than we anticipate. I have to tell you, I'm very excited because I get the weekly there's a whole viral panel that the UNC does in the emergency department. Every week they report it. And so far, the viral spike is not happening. And I think social distancing, wearing masks, and this kind of thing are really holding the line. If we can just get the COVID-19 vaccine rolled out, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we have one of the mildest flu and virus seasons on record. You know, the fact that those are not going up, but COVID-19 is, you know, it just emphasizes how contagious COVID is.
Managing your patients' needs across multiple specialties is increasingly important, but also an increasingly challenging task. U.S. Post-Acute Care now offers clinical staffing solutions not only for primary care medicine, but also for behavioral health, chronic care management, and telehealth, bringing you a more comprehensive solution for your patients and your facilities. Now more than ever, your patients need you in so many ways. Let U.S. Post-Acute Care help you deliver more complete quality care. For more information, visit us at uspostacutecare.com.
Well, before we blow by on this topic, along the same lines, another article featured in the December 2020 JAMDA looks specifically at clinical suspicion of COVID-19 in nursing home residents. Dr. Brown, what can we learn from this paper?
So this is a prospective cohort study, which was conducted in a large group of Dutch nursing home residents back in the spring when COVID-19 was just rolling out in their facilities, and it was a heavy flu and respiratory virus season. The kind of thing we might anticipate here this winter, but as Phil just mentioned, so far has not been the case. The paper reports on over 2,000 nursing home residents who were in facilities with COVID-19 outbreaks and were suspected clinically of having COVID-19 and therefore were tested. Diagnostic status and symptomatology were followed, and mortality and risk factors for mortality were extracted from the medical record. In the sample of residents with clinically suspected COVID-19, COVID testing was positive in only 38% of the residents. Thus, overall, about 40% of the residents with clinically suspected COVID-19 actually had COVID-19 based on the PCR test. So this is what we might expect here if we have flu and other respiratory viruses around as much this winter as they were last year. It emphasizes the importance of using a low threshold to test nursing home residents for COVID-19. This is of vital importance because detecting positive COVID-19 diagnoses in nursing homes is extremely important, as we know, and is an essential prerequisite to using limited personal protective equipment and quarantine and isolation measures efficiently. Furthermore, this study demonstrated that COVID-19 affects male residents disproportionately, and mortality was almost twice as high for men than for women. It's been suggested that gender differences in comorbidity could explain this effect. However, the data demonstrate that the increased mortality risk for men remained even when corrected for age and comorbidities. Phil, what do you see as the key takeaways from this study in the Netherlands?
Well, Mallory, I think you've summarized the paper very well. There's one other interesting point to me. That is that while the 30-day mortality rate among the COVID-positive patients is very high, a little over 40%, the mortality rate in the COVID-negative patients was not insignificant. 15% of those also died in 30 days.
I frankly remain amazed at just how much disparity this virus has spotlighted. It's, you know, and now we're talking about gender differences as well. This virus just continues to amaze. Our Our last paper for today is a position paper from AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. It's a paper we all should read, and we all should really be thinking about. Dr. Sloan, tell us a little bit more.
Well, it deals with a very popular topic among long-term care providers, complaining about the unfairness of the nursing home survey process. Their point of departure was the over $600,000 fine levied on the first nursing home to experience a COVID-19 outbreak. Cynically, you know, we can say that the fine was essentially for failure to be prepared for something that nobody knew was coming.
Yeah. You know, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but when Kirkland was reported, it might as well have been that it was any of our nursing facilities. It just, it was just so striking and so palpable and so emotional for me. And I could not help but reflect on the unfairness of it all. And it's something that is still extremely impactful as we continue along with this crisis.
And that's why the authors, I think, started with this case, because they felt it was a particularly egregious example of the worst aspects of nursing home surveys.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the authors, these are really some of the best, present company excluded, in the society. You have Dr. Afra Nazir, who's the immediate past president, Dr. Carl Steinberg, who's the president-elect of the society. I think anyone who's listening to this podcast or has or is involved in post-acute and long-term care has heard of Dr. Mike Wasserman, who's the immediate past president of the California Association of Long-Term Care Medicine and has just been a vocal advocate for geriatrics, nursing facilities, you know, a leader. Alan Horowitz, who I think many of us have heard speak, who's an attorney specializing in healthcare. And Dr. Jim Lett, an extremely familiar name, another past president of the society, a leader in transitions of care, and really one of the most profound and philosophical members of AMDA. And the title itself, Time to Upgrade the Survey Process, is somewhat provocative. I know that there is a task force that that convened as well last year. What has become of all this, Dr. Sloan?
Well, they listed 12 points about the survey process. And the main ones that I want to talk about are, first of all, surveys improve regulatory compliance, but evidence for improvement in quality of care is lacking. Additionally, the survey process focuses on adversarial and punitive practices rather than constructive feedback. They also note that civil monetary penalties that siphon money from nursing home operations that cannot improve quality of care, you know, in already financially strapped nursing home operations. This is a big issue. You know, I often think of them as too often taking money away from poor facilities and giving them to ones that have more resources. They feel that the survey process is not conducive to person-centered care or to innovations in care delivery, but more to maintaining the status quo and promoting susceptibility to gaming. The survey process, at least anecdotally, they feel negatively affects team morale. I have to tell you one time, you know, we do research and we go to nursing homes a lot, and we used to use a state car because we work for the university that's a state organization. But we discovered if they saw that state car in their parking lot, they would pay. So we don't do it anymore. And that's the morale issue.
Wow.
And then finally, there's a lack, they feel, of engagement of geriatric experts in the assessment of nursing home performance, and little use of evidence-based lessons from such fields as behavioral economics. They also note that people have been complaining about the survey process for decades, but nothing seems to happen. Instead, any questioning of the survey process, they say, is often interpreted as a desire to ignore bad care.
Dr. Sloan, I want to talk about this idea of bad care. you know, punitive actions or blame. So excuse me while I get on my soapbox. Today, more than ever, healthcare and businesses in general are focusing on systems, how systems operate and how systems integrate. In fact, AMDA is teaching systems thinking in its core education on medical directorship. You know, the paper mentions only briefly, but it does mention it, the concept of just culture, which is a systems thinking idea. It's a belief that mistakes come about through faulty organizational structures, cultures, or systems, but not individuals. You know, just culture is the opposite of a blame culture, and it asks what went wrong instead of, you know, who blew it. And if you think about Kirkland, nobody asked what went wrong. They just said, you blew it. And so, you know, just culture asks us to look at systems, make appropriate modifications to them, and prevent future issues. You know, I would love it if the survey process operated under a just culture, not punitive, but, you know, really looking for answers of why things are the way they are. Why can't we initiate these changes in the survey process towards a just culture? You know, these 12 points are important. They are looking at the survey system, but I don't understand what the barrier to change or improvement is here. It just seems so obviously flawed. You know, where do you start?
It's such a difficult issue. You know, I mean, I read their recommendations and I was frankly, you know, not very impressed, you know, that they didn't go far enough. You know, they said, we'll focus on not just on the bad, but the good, and employ research proven techniques and so on, you know, quality improvement. You know, the system is just, it just doesn't seem to be working. But on the other hand, it's the bad apples that get the press. It's the bad apples that get attention, you know, and consumers, you know, are always wanting to know, you know, which are the worst and what are the bad things that are happening. I'm becoming, you know, discouraged about the potential of real change, although we all know it needs to happen. In fact, of all the stuff they recommend, the only thing I thought was at least a little bit interesting was they asked to formally get customer satisfaction feedback after each survey visit.
And so this to me is really the beginning of maybe what needs to happen. And that is, you know, the concept of quality, enhancing quality, in this case through customer satisfaction feedback, much like, you know, CAPS surveys, and figuring out, you know, how this all can pertain to, you know, maybe cost savings or something along those lines. But, you know, quality over cost, which is value. I would really like to see the survey process changed in that way. But I have to tell you, if the authors on this paper and who these authors are cannot motivate innovative change, I am concerned about future issues which might come up.
Well, you know, that may be one of the advantages of COVID having really shined a light on nursing facilities.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this is the one time that there may be an opportunity to affect some pretty significant change.
I agree, and it makes me think of the term for crisis, which is WeChi, danger and opportunity. Mm-hmm. We've experienced the danger, and I really hope we take advantage of the opportunity. That concludes our December 2020 issue of JAMDA podcast. Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief Drs. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and with the support of editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association continues to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Take a look at the December 2020 issue. As an aside, this podcast will bring to a close the AMDA On The Go series for 2020. Happy New Year to all of our listeners and guests throughout the year as we are on the cusp of 100,000 downloads for the series. And we are so looking forward to what 2021 will bring to us all. And hopefully much wellness and much safety. Dr. Sloan, Dr. Brown, Happy New Year. And thank you for spending your time once again with JAMDA on the Go.
Well, thank you so much, and Happy New Year to our listeners. And thank you to everyone who has been participating in JAMDA.
Happy New Year.
References for this podcast can be found at www.jamda.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA on the Go.
If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.